few. But they all are interwoven with our response or lack of response to climate change. 2 months ago, yet another global climate change summit ended in dismal failure, this one in Doha, Qatar. And once again, a thin fig leaf of an agreement was rolled out, one that hardly conceals the sour reality that little of meaningful value had been agreed to. Question: how do we make it impossible for that unconscionable inaction to continue? How do we counteract the power of the fossil fuel industry, the oil, coal, and gas companies? Key to the oil and coal industry's power is their stranglehold on Washington, D.C., and their ability to perpetuate myths of their competence and that we are incapable of reorganizing our lives to meet our energy needs in a sustainable way without them. Let us turn away from the storylines that serve the oil and coal industry and the mainstream national media that doesn't seem to have the gumption to seriously question that industry's faulty logic, and turn our attention to the storylines that remind us of human capacity to act for the broader good. Let us reflect on stories that offer a credible case that humans are up to the task before us. First, let's consider a riveting assessment of human nature, crisis, and response. Author Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell. Solnit reviews human response to a number of massive disasters, such as Hurricane Katrina, the Mexico City earthquake, and the aftermath of 9/11 in New York City. She makes a strong case that the overwhelming mass of human response in those crises is exemplary and cooperative, and that notable civil communities can quickly emerge as ordinary people organized to aid rescue and relief efforts. Solnit also notes that stories of misbehavior after these disasters are erroneous or vastly exaggerated, and in her opinion, reflect the anxieties of economic elites. Elites that panic if they think things are out of control. She notes that as the need for rescue and relief eases, the ad hoc communities fade. As participants return to their regular lives, they often feel a lingering loss and miss the common sense of purpose that had been present. Rebecca Solnit's writing offers a sense of human possibility and is well worth our consideration. Scan our state's history, and that sense of possibility continues to grow. If we review the notable record of Wisconsin's robust citizens' conservation campaigns, we will find considerable evidence that Wisconsinites find bedrock strength amid environmental crises. One notable citizens' campaign involving tens of thousands of citizens, a broad alliance of Native Americans, sport fishing groups, and conservationists, a 27-year-long saga, protected the Wolf River from an ill-advised proposal for a metallic sulfide mine near its headwaters at Crandon. Wisconsinites never blinked, and among the mine proponents that backed off was Exxon, then our planet's largest corporation. That campaign led to a show me it is safe first law on metallic sulfide mining in 1997. The 27-6 vote in the state Senate and a 91-6 vote in the state assembly reflected the overwhelming public support for the measure, and it was signed into law. Ordinary people do extraordinary things, and historic changes happen. A few miles south of the Lake Superior shoreline, a parallel storyline unfolded in 1996. Despite objections, a Wisconsin Central Railroad train carrying the first of a planned total of 550 million gallons of sulfuric acid was nearing the reservation of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe near Ashland. Ojibwe leader and journalist Walter Brissette and other local citizens feared a derailment. The tracks and railroad bridges were rickety and in poor shape. The trains limited to 10 miles per hour. In addition, they objected to the acid's planned use to flush the remnant copper from the White Pine Mine. If you've been to the Porcupine Mountains, you may recognize that mine a few miles south of the east end of the park. Incredibly, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency had not blocked the plan to use the acid, despite the mine's location a mere 5 miles upstream of Lake Superior. In a dramatic move, Brissette and six colleagues stood on the train tracks, literally said, "You're not coming through here," and blocked the train at the reservation boundary. Brissette also resigned from an EPA advisory board in protest of the agency's ill-advised inaction on the acid plant. The blockade grew and lasted 28 days as local conservationists joined their Native American allies and the EPA reversed its decision. The plan to flush the mine with acid never happened. Ordinary people do extraordinary things, and historic changes happen. A little east of where we are now gathered, another worthy narrative developed in Milwaukee. A few years back, Gretchen Mead was a Milwaukee social worker. Raised in rural Illinois, she had grown up in a self-reliant family that grew or foraged much of their own food and enjoyed nutritious meals. That self-help, take the initiative and get stuff done part of her family upbringing is an enduring theme in her life and work. As her social work experience increased, she felt uncomfortable with practices that didn't include solutions, particularly concerning nutrition. Realizing that many of the problems she was seeing as a social worker were the result of an industrialized food system and her clients' lack of access to healthy food, she wanted to fix the broken food system. She knew there was another way, that in her words, food and money are not equivalent. We can have access to a great deal of nutritious food without earning money if we grow our own. In early 2008, Mead and a few others founded the Victory Garden Initiative. An idea surfaced to harness people's energy later that spring to install as many raised bed gardens as possible in a one-day blitz. Doubts were expressed. Time was short. Gretchen rolled into action and got it done, finding the supplies and leading an energetic crew on the first blitz day. This last spring was the fourth annual Victory Garden Blitz, and volunteers installed nearly 300 gardens. I was one of them. In addition, Victory Garden Initiative is educating gardeners and training community leaders. Notably, Victory Garden Initiative has steadily gained influence in Milwaukee and won the Milwaukee Section Award for New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's national competition for a compelling urban vision. With a project to turn empty lots and foreclosed homes into community-based food system hubs. Gretchen Mead and her enthusiastic get stuff done attitude has been the spark for all this. Other dynamic activists are also making an impact. Climate change hero Tim DeChristopher has attracted a nationwide following. His essay, Activism is an Act of Faith, was published in a recent issue of UU World magazine. Three summers ago, I was in the Upper Peninsula attending the Protect the Earth Summit, an annual gathering of tribal folks and other conservation activists. I was struck by the comments of a 28-year-old activist from Utah, Tim DeChristopher, who was facing federal charges of disrupting a gas drilling land auction of parcels of land, of federal land near Utah National Parks. During the last days of the Bush administration, Tim had entered a federal gas drilling land auction. Asked if he was there to bid, he was surprised, but replied, yes. He took a bidding paddle and proceeded to bid prices upward and won several leases before being arrested for misrepresenting himself as a buyer. Later, a federal judge threw out the whole auction, saying the government's process leading up to it had been illegal. Despite that, the federal government chose to prosecute DeChristopher. What I noticed during that weekend in the UP was that Tim had obviously given considerable thought to climate change and what it meant for his generation, a generation who have inherited the whole mess. He was serious about asking the big questions about climate change and how citizens formulate an effective response. What he had done at the land auction was not premeditated, and during the years since that act, Tim had developed a poised philosophy of nonviolent civil disobedience and found a community of support. Part of that community was the environmental movement and notable figures such as authors Terry Tempest Williams and Bill McKibben. Another large part of Tim's support was his faith community, First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. Tim had become a hero. Many wondered what to do about climate change. Tim did something. Something that blocked the power of the oil and gas industry, even if momentarily. At his sentencing hearing, Tim offered an eloquent defense, saying, "At this point of unimaginable threats on the horizon, this is what hope looks like. In these times of a morally bankrupt government that has sold out its principles, this is what patriotism looks like. With countless lives on the line, this is what love looks like. And it will only grow." He was sentenced to 2 years in prison and taken into custody on the spot. At this point, his sentence is winding down, and he is on work release, employed in a Salt Lake City bookstore. Judging from his recent essay in UU World magazine, confinement has not put a dent in his spirit, and we can continue to look forward to strong ideas and action from him. Tim's phrase, "This is what love looks like," lingered in my thoughts. I had had vaguely similar thoughts as I searched for what it is that motivates any of us to live a lifetime of activism and good deeds. It's not anger, and I come to doubt if it is intellectual conviction alone. I come to believe that affection is the motivation that endures. Affection for our fellow humans and the green-blue planet we call home. Stories refine our affection and strengthen it into a life force that weathers the inevitable bumps along the way. So consider this. For us to advance our conversation and campaign to build a sustainable and just future for all, we need a sophisticated knowledge of human capacity for good amid disaster, as Rebecca Solnit shares with us. In addition, we need to search out, reflect on, and pass on to others the empowering storylines of our fellow citizens' successes as they campaign for the common good. We also need to support those who speak truth to power, like Walter Brissett and Tim DeChristopher. And we need the community transformation that Gretchen Mead and Victory Garden Initiative do so well. Transformation that lessens our dependency on a fossil fuel-based and distant food chain, grows healthy food in our neighborhoods, and simultaneously builds our sense of community and empowerment. History offers one more critical insight. When citizens organize and demand meaningful action, governments move into motion. We need to keep the pressure on. Five things I ask of you and ask of myself. Believe with all of the strength that you have that our planet and the future of humanity is well worth going through changes for. There is no planet B. Consider all people, both near and far, as key potential partners in the most momentous human discussion and campaign ever. Seek out, experience, and share empowering stories. Believe in the cumulative power of what may momentarily appear to be small acts. Keep on pushing. Insist that local and national governments and corporations work for real solutions, not mere talk. Settle for nothing less. Crisis clarifies our deepest beliefs and affections, our spirituality. In turn, these moments of great clarity prompt ordinary people to do extraordinary things, and historic changes happen. Thus ends our message for this morning. In a few moments, we'll have time in the program, I believe, to hear some of your thoughts on this topic. But for now, for this moment, let us sing and remind ourselves of all that we love. Number 121, "We'll Build a Land."
Thank you. have time for just a couple of sharing in the polylog? So maybe two or three.
Please.
I also struggled with how to tell the story. Many emails went back and forth, and the reason I chose that was I thought that there would be young children here, and so I thought I should tell it two ways.
Jerry?
Well, thank you, Aaron, for being here and talking to us about these important topics. Regarding the episode where the person went to jail for misbidding at the gas lease auction, there is a movie out that I believe it's the Ministry for Earth has a license for, and I think we're going to show that here as one of our movies that matters, so watch for it. On a slightly another vein here, as far as what's going on, there's a lot going on in the state of Wisconsin now. There's issues with the mine at near Lake Superior, and it just came, there was just a news article in today's paper that we do have in the state of Wisconsin a renewable energy portfolio standard that says by 2015, 10% of electricity generated in the state must come from renewable sources. And the electric companies are well on track for doing that. However, there's an issue now that one of the nuclear power plants along Lake Michigan is being closed down because it's no longer competitive for the price of natural gas for generating electricity. So our legislature has it in the works now to substitute nuclear power with new renewable energy. So if you don't like that, let your legislators know.
Let me speak to Tim's history partly. You may have noticed his essay in a recent issue of UU World magazine. There's also persistent rumors that Tim is considering entering seminary to become a UU minister. If he becomes a pulpit guest, I predict record attendance wherever he goes. Let me also speak to the mining issue because I work on the mine campaign a lot. Chairman Mike Wiggins, chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, along with other members of the tribe, will be down here on Tuesday and from 5 to 7 at the Urban Ecology Center on Milwaukee's east side. We'll have a community educational event, and I'll be speaking there as well as Chairman Mike Wiggins and many other people. Just a comment on the moral urgency of what's happened with the mine issue and with this new bill that attempts to reverse what I outlined in the sermon. You know, this huge vote of 91-6 in the state assembly. Every once in a while you hear that legislation described as a beer party. It was not. I mean, there was an extensive civic discussion, citizen science that led up to that bill. And, of course, the mining companies hate it. And what's happened in the last year with these SB1 or Assembly Bill 1 or whatever is that it's moved way beyond a clean water issue. It's become a clean government issue because what's at issue here is your right to know what's going on. They've got 250 core samples for that proposed mine in the Pinokies, and they are, quote, proprietary. And they say that they'll share that with the public after the permit is issued. The critical thing with these bills is whether you have a right to know and whether you can rebut that. And beyond even clean government, the blatant racism that is being thrown at the Bad River people, or just 4 miles downstream from this mine that would be 20 miles long. The other day on Lake Effect, I described this mine as start at Summerfest, drive to the west end of Pewaukee Lake. That is the size of this mine this proposed industrial sacrifice zone. And with that, I got to say that the moral urgency is approaching a Selma, Alabama moment in Wisconsin politics. It's very important that we stand with our colleagues from the Bad River Band. Also say that they're very eloquent, and you will be inspired as you get to know them, as I've gotten to know them. Please.
Hi. My name is Helen, and I struggle with the science. And I've been on with the Environmental Action League in Waukesha for a long time. So the other one that's coming up is plasma gasification, which I don't understand a lot of the science of. And if we can all come to the table, my brother's an engineer, and he's been an engineer for many utilities throughout the last 30 years. So sometimes, because he knows it's coming from me, a concerned citizen, so the science I don't understand, and I ask him to break it down. So even among your neighbors, have that discussion whether you be, you know, you don't know if you're for or against until you get the information. And, you know, I'm trying to understand the processes and involved, in, but like you said, I have my right to know. I get to know the information, I get to know the science, and it's not arbitrarily, you know, proprietary corporate secrets, because sometimes he'll just explain it to me. This is what they own for the science, but he'll break it down for me on the processes and how it might work. So seek out a few, you know, the answers.
Eric, we have one more.
Hi. I know we're talking about a lot of big things that are happening and big changes. But I can't help but think of the little things we can do every day that are important with the environment, with people's rights. So although we are talking about the big things that we can do, I think it's important to remember all the small things we do each and every day that make a difference.
Thank you very much for that. It's so important to believe that small acts lead to a very big thing. Also, I'll be here to talk to people as long as people want to talk. I'll also be accompanied by my colleague, Juanita Kratz, who works with me at the Earth Justice Ministry at First Unitarian, also works for Citizens Climate Lobby and 350.org. And Juanita is very well informed on a lot of these things. Thank you for all that.
So anybody who wishes to continue this dialogue, you can join Eric for coffee.
Our closing words. I'm sorry, did I? Louder.
Thank you, and now we'll have the offertory, which... which will be in silence today.
Closing words today come to us from me. It's called A Place Where Water Sparkles, and it goes like this. We know we are fortunate to spend our days here in a land we know as Wisconsin, a place where water sparkles and is well worth caring for, where gurgling streams and wave-washed shores soothe our lives, where the bubbling springs of the moraine country and the timeless flow of the Muckwanico River brighten our Sunday afternoons, where a canoe trip to Lowy Lake or Horicon Marsh is a nearby treat. To our north, our region's spiritual homeland, the magnificent headwaters country of our planet's finest collection of fresh water. May our thoughts and words in the days to come have the liquid flowing grace of that sweet water. Sometimes a deep still pool, sometimes a sparkling cascade or a thundering waterfall, each drop precious in itself and an offering to the greater good. And if the spirits of this place ask if we are worthy of that grace, the answer shall be yes. For we do not seek shallow pleasures or speak merely to hear the sound of our own voices. Rather, we seek that most lasting of joys, listening to the voices of our community's children and their children as they see the magical sights that we have known. For thousands of years, ever since the great ice melted, the pristine waters of this place have nurtured and inspired. May it be so for another 10,000 years. ¶¶